Nathan Englander is one of the most talented, I think, and one of the hottest writers currently in America, really. In fact, globally, he's a global writer now. And why he's in Madison, Wisconsin, we have trouble finding out. But we're going to find out right now. He's with us, Nathan Englander, joining us right now on our stage here in Madison, Wisconsin. And how are you? Good to meet you. I can't believe you're going to leave the glories of 5-degree Madison, Wisconsin for what? For Israel?
Yeah, I'm leaving on Tuesday, I think.
So. Yeah? How can you leave this all behind?
Well, I just thought, you know, now that they're bombing Syrian convoys, it'd be a great time to have a visit.
Good time to make a visit. Now, what is your connection here in Madison? I've heard that you were here. We do have some, like, celebrity types in Madison. Well, Lori Moore, I know. She's not far from me.
Yeah, and Lori's a good, she's a friend.
Yeah, but is Madison some sort of a literary capital?
That's funny. I thought Lori was going to get a restraining order against me. I was looking for the writer's mafia. I was like, want to have lunch? Want to have breakfast? Want to have a drink? So she's in New York this semester, and I think it may be because I came back. But sitting in the audience is my wife, Rachel, who is getting a couple of PhDs here. So
she is. What's she in?
Educational Policy Studies and Anthropology.
Do we know what that is yet, or are we still?
I have a general idea.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Yeah. Can one make a living at that? Is the important question?
She would scream out no. But yes, it's a great thing. Yeah, she actually had been working in the Dadaab refugee camps on the Kenya-Somali border with women's refugee education and got interested in that, and now has sort of switched her research to Malawi. And I think I always say one person in every couple should be nice. I think it makes a nice balance. Yeah.
So you're not the nice one?
No. No, I try to be. I try to be.
Trying to be. Now, were you born in the Bronx or in Queens? Or?
It's one of those rolling facts. According to wherever you look, I get born in lots of places. Yeah. But I used to hide from it for a long time. But I was born in Long Island, Strong Island, New York.
Yeah, oh, you were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And did you go to school out there?
Yes, it was. This is. I need a whiteboard for this. I can use your map and show the motion of like. Jewish folk in the 60s from, Lower East Side to Brooklyn and then out to Long Island to have, front yards. So, yes, my parents were part of building a little Jewish ghetto in suburbia in which I was raised.
Yeah. And you were Orthodox?
Full on, yeah. 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 Still, is today Saturday?
It is, yes.
And so. I shouldn't be on the radio.
No, you shouldn't be. Exactly. But I think there's dispensation for this.
I'm not sure why. Exactly.
I think Rabbi Twersky probably.
Exactly.
I loved what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank. It's a great collection of
Thank
stories.
Thank you so much.
And there's a couple of reasons. One, because it means there is actually still a Jewish writer. And we used to be able to back up a long time. When I went to school here at the University of Wisconsin, a life-changing course for me was I took a course on Jewish writers. And I read the Malamud and of course, Bello and all these people. And I love the fact, I guess what I liked about it the best was that they were writing about my father's generation of newcomers.
Yes.
Coming to this country, and they, the guys who would do anything to make a living, basically, and all this, and all the family interactions and so forth. But they go in to Philip Roth.
Yes.
And there's like a sea change, and it's suddenly, he's the Americanized, and he's the rebel, and so forth. And it was like that period was over where there was someone writing the Jewish writer actually writing about that and not sort of rebelling against it. And then there's you.
Yeah. Yes, here
and
I am.
And it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess it sort of maps, that's what literature does. It's both this, there's the books and the stories, and then there's a way you can, if I already mentioned anthropology, but you can map it sort of anthropologically.
Yeah.
But sort of this idea where I feel like I really do look at those generations, and Philip's turning 80, this happy birthday to him.
Yeah.
But he's, you see this idea of like Singer, there was the people, in my father's court where, they were breaking out into the world, and then there was this idea of these American writers, all the dreams. Roth's the perfect example of dreaming of like, going to the secular college, going to the yuppie college, going to the, being preppy, dating the blonde girl, this idea of being Americanized. And I feel like that was that generation's fight. It's hard for me even to imagine places that didn't, the next town over where Jews, couldn't buy a house or weren't hired for a job. I think it's sort of the success of America that, the success of that this melting pot idea. And, as we have our, black president for his, second term, it's miraculous. But I think the success of that generation of Jews in truly becoming American allowed for, my generation to be utterly you know, ghettoized again. I think that was this idea of like first acceptance and then this idea of the special interest group where, you know, after acceptance where they could send us to Jewish schools and utterly, you know, close us off. So for me, I feel like almost closer to the generation before, like Singer's generation, for me being out in the world is a wildly exciting thing. I, you know, had this truly sheltered, you know, Long Island shtetl existence.
Yeah, yeah. Not so different from Milwaukee. I mean, I don't know. It's a funny thing because, you know, I'm certainly Americanized. But you have this background, and your parents had this background that was so different from your own, and the things they had to deal with. And even this concept of anti-Semitism or something, I tell it to my daughters and stuff, they don't know what I'm talking about. They really, they've never had, you know, no one's even said, you know, a nasty thing to them, apparently.
Right.
And I'm glad for that. But, you know, at the same time, I think, wow, they should know, you know, how we suffered and what happened, you know, and all this stuff and all that. But it's hard to explain to them. I grew up in Milwaukee, which is basically a German city with Jews sprinkled around it, or, you know, and that's why the story you have about the Blums.
That was How We Avenged the Blums, which is a story about these kids having a battle with the local anti-Semite.
So. Yeah, who turns out to be Jewish, actually, isn't he? He's half Jewish.
Well, I always like that. It's a very strange culturally Jewish thing. Like, the worse the enemy, the more eventually these rumors raise up, and then you're like, do you know Hitler had a Jewish cousin? You know, there's this strange Jewifying of the enemy in a really strange concept, except for the fact this story, I could give those sort of cultural ideas of how things work. But I'm usually saying, you know, everything is fiction. But of all the stories that I've ever written, that one is utterly based on a war we had with the local anti-Semite. Exactly what you're saying about your daughter. Like, it's hard to explain that, like, 20 minutes from Manhattan, you know, not far from, you know, 47th Street and the Diamond District and Brooklyn and all this stuff, that we had a full-on battle with this, you know, anti-Semite in our town. It was just insane. And yes, we all believed that the father was Jewish. This was part of our belief.
But were you one of the Blums?
No, not in imagining or not in thing. But yeah, that's a very, you know, not to get all serious, but it's a real primal memory for me. I remember of like being surrounded by these kids and racing home. And it's this idea of my parents racing out of the house to sort of rescue my sister. But that was just part of our life, was getting chased home from school. I'm not fast on a basketball court, but if you chase me with a yarmulke, I can move.
I got jumped by a kid going to Sherman School, Mount Calvary. I always want to say Calvary, but it's Calvary. He jumped me, and there was some, you know, I heard the word Jew. I knew it was just involving it, you know.
You looked around.
He got me in an arm in the alley there, right on where my aunt Ida lived, right on the alley there, and she saw through the window, and she called my mother, and she said, "They're killing Michael. They're killing." And I wasn't much of a fighter, you know, so I got out of it, but he got the better of it and stuff. But that sort of stuff was always happening. And for no particular, I mean, all my friends were, you know, were Lutheran or whatever, you know, Catholic. But, you know, if someone wanted to get at you, that's what they would say. They'd bring up the Jewish thing and your responsibility for something that you didn't, you know, weren't really responsible for.
Right.
And that was sort of the atmosphere growing up, and it was very odd, you know. Because even a friend would turn on you just to use that, you know, if the situation was useful or something.
Yeah.
Odd, but totally different now. But I love the fact that the kids in this story, they go looking for like a golem.
Yes, they find the biggest kid in town to beat the anti-Semite for them.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's actually it's a funny story, but it's also, it resonates.
Yes, the stories are funnier than they describe.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's a Holocaust romp, that story.
Yeah. I know. You know, and that reminds me of this, the other story, the title story, where the couples are talking. One, the Orthodox friends, two women friends who were Orthodox, one ends up marrying and going to Israel. And being more so. And her other friend marries a guy who's Jewish, I guess, but he's pretty Americanized. And she becomes less so. But they meet again after all these years, and they have this kind of a drunken party where they discuss all these issues.
Yes.
And that's very illuminating. Sorry, if people wanted to know sort of about what, you know, the Jewish mindset or something, it really brings it all out there.
Well, I mean, it's a good show to be on this, that with a question mark at the end of your name, but I think there's a reason I write fiction, is I don't have a lot of answers, I have a lot of questions. And for me, one, it's based on Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, and I thought in a sense, what if we, it's the title of the book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, if we replace that idea of love or mix it in with ideas of, you know, history and the Holocaust and memory. But, you know, this is back. I did live in Israel for 5 or 6 years. You know, the book just came out in Hebrew yesterday. That's why I'm going for book tour. Oh. But it's that notion there of that sense of knowing and surety. And I guess the story is really about who owns history or who owns memory. You know, this idea of being more religious people. I mean, I think about it a lot. And I think a lot of it's an echo of, you know, this American election year of people claiming true knowing of things for others. And I think it sort of obsessed me in this. I think the book got written in this, you know, in our 4-year election cycle, but I just kept hearing people banging their Bibles and getting on the radio and telling other people how to live with such clarity. And I thought it's, you know, mm-hmm. who owns what?
Yeah. And one of the things I like about it is that the Holocaust joke, which is a verboten kind of thing, you don't tell yes. them about the numbers on the hand.
Yes. Yeah, well, there's a very dark joke in there, but yeah. I thought, you know, this idea when people try to make things sacred, I think that's a very dangerous thing in the world and in history. You know, this idea of, you know, how genocides get committed, or, you know, this idea of even being beaten from school. When you identify with someone else as human or the same, you don't, you know, that's not who you attack. It's the dehumanizing thing. And I think there's this idea of protecting certain things in history. We don't talk about them. We don't. You know, it was like Bill, you know, you made the wrong comment, like when Bill Maher lost a show post 9/11. I think there's certain ways where people try to protect things that don't actually protect them. And I think if you actually grow up in a world with Holocaust survivors or the kids of survivors, like they say the dark, I remember my friend, you know, I was in high school the first time, like this friend Paul said to his dad, who was an Auschwitz survivor, like, at least you got to go to camp. You know, and I remember like, you know. But this idea.
He's entitled.
This is if you're building a reality, like that's really how people talk. You know, they're not disrespecting the memory. They're living the memory, and they're living with the repercussions and the murdered relative and the whole idea of history and lost family. The point is that's not disrespectful. That's when you're building a reality. There's always that balance of tension or you explode. And I think that's how humor forms. So, yes, I think not allowing that kind of reference, that's an outsider protecting something from the outside. Yeah. But an insider deals with everything differently. And I don't think, you know, that's why fiction would be flat. I think the funniest things, you know, at least in my world, if someone calls, God forbid, you shouldn't know from it. But if someone calls with an emergency or bad news, they usually make a joke in that. You know, I feel like there's a real balance that the funniest things are kind of dark, at least to me, and the darkest things always have this release valve.
Yeah. And they're living with how they're living with it. That's how you live with it, with trying to put it into some.
Yes, and I think where the Madison Library could tip over from the PhDs that are written, I'm sure, but like so many psychology, you know, they do, there are just probably stacks of them, people doing their theses on, you know, first generation, you know, what it is to grow up in these homes of survivors, what it is to live with that very strange, you know, pressure on you.
Yeah. And this story, they're in a locker room of a club or something like that, and they're changing.
Story is this, yes, the son's, the ultra-Orthodox son's visiting his father, and they're in this locker room, and the son notices that the numbers, the guy changing next to him, you know, I say like they're two big beige manatees, and I say, you know, pulling the sock on's the whole workout in itself, basically. But these two old guys, he notices the numbers on their arms are two numbers apart. You know, like that these guys were two people away from line, and he wants this huge moment, exactly my point of these things, of trying to add, import, an ad thing, and he finally gets them to acknowledge a difference in numbers, and the father says, you know, all it shows is this guy's a cutter, you know, like he cuts in line. He cut me there, and he cuts me here, you know, and it's this huge, huge deflation, but you know what, like you see these things, and there was a piece in the Times, whatever you write in fiction, it's crazy, whatever you can dream up, if you put it down, it'll start appearing. Like I saw a thing in the Times, there was a video of a woman, you know, just months after the book came out, saying how she was somewhere and found someone, you know, people, like I just then saw a story of, you know, someone bumping into someone with numbers right nearby. And I mean, the best example is from my first book. I had a story about Reb Kringle, about a poor Hasidic man who's big and fat with a white beard who can only support his synagogue by working as Santa Claus. And, you know, I did not know that, you know, I was writing in my room. I didn't know the book was going to have any success, but I have traveled America. I have met more Jewish Santas than you can imagine. They come special. Big, fat, white-bearded Jewish Santas, like, wait for me. Those are my, you know.
Yeah. How does it play in Israel? I mean, I guess you'll find out when you get there.
I guess I'll find out when I get there. Yeah. It's funny. I actually always get back to that idea of knowing. You know, I think they like their American Jewish writers in the sort of mold that you were describing as cultural Jews writing about America. Mm. And a lot of my stuff is, you know, I lived there many years, is concerned with a lot of the concerns about, you know, I have a story about exploration of the settlements. And so I'm always very sensitive before I get there to see the people on the report. Journalists have been nice on the phone, but we'll see. You never know till you get off the plane if they'll be, you know,
Yeah.
You know, who's waiting for you on
you
the
have,
other end?
You haven't heard on the grapevine or anything, people...
The journalists have been... Review, it literally just... The reviews will hit soon, so...
Just the reviewers, not...
Yeah. Well, it's one day out, so...
Do you expect it would be sort of a different reaction than American audiences would have to this American?
Yeah, I think I have to say, and this is, I try and be cynical all the time and make jokes about everything, but the sincere thing for me, I feel very fortunate to try. I've been, you know, this year to, you know, I don't know, Italy and Germany and Austria and, you know, Scotland and Wales. I know, the point is traveling around the world with a book, you see the power, like what... I'm not saying in my book, but the idea that a book, when you think of translation, that somebody has taken my whole book and replaced every word with another word, you know, like they've taken out every word that I spent years writing and replaced them with another word in another alphabet in another language, and that someone can have that experience, like that is so universal and human, and it's fascinating to me, and every country is different, and you get this experience. I mean, for me, a huge moment, like two huge moments was when I got to Amsterdam. This book is called, you know, there's not Anne Frank in the book, it's the idea in the title, but for someone in Amsterdam to say to me, like, how do you use the name Anne Frank in your book? Or so, you know, like, to really be faced with that question in front of an audience and need to acknowledge what it means and, you know, what she means to us here versus what she means in that city versus, you know, or in Austria, you know, back to this Holocaust joke, Austrian gentleman in the audience raised his hand and said, you know, I read the section, thank you for referencing it, but I read that scene and he was like, I don't know if we're ready for a book like this in Austria. And I said, thank you, I don't know if you should be. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're ready in the States. Like, you're literally, it plays differently, and you know, for each individual, but even every nation, and it's really helps me come home and write to understand how a story moves through the world.
Yeah. Just on the Israeli, like, American Jewish front, there's, I'm maybe speaking out of church here, I guess, in saying this, but, there, you know, Israelis oftentimes don't have much...
I'm going to agree with whatever you say.
Yeah, so. They don't really much... care for or even consider them to be actually Jewish American Jews because they are so they're not Orthodox, they're not practicing.
But I love that sort of I don't understand why American Jews have problem with it. The most famous case, and I was actually in the room with Aleph Bet Yehoshua, a very famous Israeli author who loves he loves to say it before he comes on American Book Tour and had to, I think, cancel one, but say, like, the American Jews are not real Jews. Like, Israel's the future for Jews. And I was at a breakfast for him, and he said it to Elie Wiesel, who is, our Jewish Santa Claus. Like, you know, to stand in front of Elie Wiesel and be like, the American Jews are not Jews. But I think you're allowed to have city pride. You know what I'm saying? I say, like, that's fine. You believe that. And you know what I'm saying? As when I'm in Jerusalem, I thought it's the best city. When I'm in New York, it's the best city. Now I'm like, I'm here in Madison. Like, I love this city. I don't mind. I don't think why it's a conflict for people, you know, especially in the challenging existential circumstances that Israel faced, for people to take great pride and believe in what they're doing. So, you know, they can think Israel's the best for Jews. You and I think Madison is clearly the future, the Jewish homeland.
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of, it's a little bit funny because Catholics don't say, man, if you're not living in the Vatican, you're not really a Catholic. You know, I mean, you know, right, you should be in Vatican City. You know?
Right. So there's a lot of empty rooms there. They could let more people live there.
And a lot to eat and drink and read. And he's got everything. He's really set up.
Post office.
Set up pretty good there. And then, well, you are actually, speaking of translating, you are translating, I thought this is unusual, or a new translation of the Passover Haggadah.
Yes, that was a crazy...
Which usually was produced by Maxwell House all the years in our family, you know, coffee on the back.
It's hard to compete. I think the book's been doing well, but it's hard to compete with a book that's prices free. They give that one away.
So do they
the
still?
Maxwell House. Yeah, there's something... I don't know if there's... It's many millions of copies in print. Yeah. They just redid the translation. But, I mean, this collection that we're talking about is really a product of two projects. There's this play that I had open in the fall and the translation. So the writer Jonathan Safran Foer, that I'm sure you've all heard of, Eating Animals and... Everything is illuminated. So the point is, Jonathan is a good friend, and he had a dream about this project, and he was not raised as religious as I was. You know, he was raised in a, I think, conservative, he's raised in a good conservative cultural family, i.e. he's less traumatized. Like, the last thing I'd want to do is spend years on a Jewish cultural project like this. But he really was adamant. He had this dream for this book and talked me into being the translator, and I'd never translated, never wanted to translate, and, you know, and also I'm a sort of like, it's like people strive to be religious. I'm like an atheist who's working on my atheism. It's always like this failed atheism that I really strive toward. But he talked me through.
Well, Jews make the best atheists. That's my dad always said that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but the point is, I was, he talked me into translating this text that's mostly, you know, that's read at Passover at the Seder, and that's where you remember the Exodus, so it's mostly biblical excerpts. And it was, you know, probably it's a few thousand words, but I spent years on it. It was a great responsibility to think that people would be worshiping from this thing that I was translating.
This is, by the way, if you don't know, on Passover, this is the book you go through and say the four questions and why is this night different from all other nights? And you're yelling a song, you got to do the four questions. So that was my deal. Who was the original author of that? Do we know? God is the one. Who took the notes on that? The original.
That's funny.
It's good writing, right?
God and then Moses' secretary. Yeah, it's mostly biblical quotes, and then there. Yeah. I mean, it's for 1,000 years. So yeah, there's some medieval stuff in there. But
someone in the Maxwell family, probably.
Exactly, Stevie Maxwell.
Yeah, from Maxwell House Coffee Brothers. Jewish, the only Jewish coffee that we knew of. My mother owned Sir Maxwell House. I said, "Mom, can we at least get some Folgers or something?"
Exactly.
What's with the Maxwell House? And the thing about it that always bothered me doing it were the what they did to the Egyptians in there.
This is the plagues.
Did you rewrite the plagues at least?
I can't believe you
lighten up on the plagues?
I can't believe you're asking this, but there were a lot of questions about translation. I thought about that a lot. It's unbelievably, there's a lot of violence in there. Yes,
horrible. Horrible.
One does not take vengeance upon people's children, but that is
the
what
firstborn,
God did.
Yes. All right, I'm the lastborn, so it's not really a problem for me, but I felt bad for Clayton.
Yes, I actually, sitting with it, I did really notice that it was a very violent thing, but that's why there's four sets of different people writing different commentaries. In fact, actually, Daniel Hender, Lemony Snicket is
doing commentary on the plagues. Did he do the plagues?
Yes, he did. He did a running commentary through it. That's quite beautiful. He's one of the funniest. Yeah, he's a super funny guy.
Yeah, I talked to him one time. He's hilarious.
Yeah. Yes, we were doing a signing in California, and the book is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, and anyone who I signed it for, he would then cross out Anne Frank and write Daniel into every copy, which to me was just
going too far.
Yeah, hysterical.
Yeah. And meaning-wise, though, I mean, there were, like, Hebrew words and English words are not necessarily, they don't go like this, they can go whatever, because they're in different places, right? Make a lot of changes in terms of the translation?
I thought about this a lot because I take everything I do compulsively seriously, but that that my, like, that it's not, you know, there's every kind of Haggadah in the world. There's, like, there's... vegan, vegetarian Haggadahs. There's God-free Haggadahs for the Jewish atheist who also wants to worship, which is an awesome space. There's an Alcoholics Anonymous Haggadah. There's Armed Forces. There's for every... But I had no agenda except loyalty to the text. I feel like, much like the Constitution,
name is God.
Yeah, well, just...
The AA.
Yeah, but this idea of like...
Hi, my name is God.
But we change society. We don't change the text. Sort of when I heard, at the inauguration, like all men are created, like it's all men and all, we don't remove, I feel like, slavery from the Constitution. This is our shame that we change our society around it. And I feel like it's not my job to change that text, but it made for me.
Well, I mean, were there some naughty words or translations that could actually change the meaning of...
Well, that's the point.
Say a plague was not a plague. It was more of a...
No, but it just sort of freaked me out of the idea of what it is when we think of how much of our world is based on, like in America, how much is based on the English Bible. That's not, if you believe in the Bible, but that's not someone else. Choices were made, like a human being. You can believe it's God's word, but it wasn't God. God's, the Italian version isn't, it's gone through a wash. And that to me, when you think of people living and dying based on word choice, that's why it took me years to think. I say, like, this idea of really to give the rhythm and meaning and feel of a word. Like, if I asked you for another single word for water that has that rhythm and that feel, you'd say liquid. No, that's not it. Like, the idea of finding words that don't translate, that have a singular, gigantic meaning. Yeah, it just was a mind bender.
Can you tell me any of those? A word or two in there that you struggled with?
I just don't want people at home to like drive off the road if they fall asleep, as I do.
No, that's okay.
God liturgy right now.
Yeah, pull over
right
now.
Have a cup of coffee while I talk about I think a big word is Eloheinu, which is God, but it's translated as our God. And I thought, for hundreds of years, and I used it's translated as our God. And I thought the word is not two words. It's not our God. It's a singular word, and it's about God. I did it with hyphens, but God of us, which was sort of a radical choice, because I thought this idea of us saying our God is sort of taking ownership of God. To keep repeating that, it loses its meaning, and it's sort of this idea there's enough conflict, but this idea of taking ownership of God, it's not that. What you're saying is you're giving yourself to God, and it's the God over us, and that was sort of
other way around,
radical in the Haggadah underground choice.
Have you heard about that particular choice?
It's Jews. I hear about everything. Every choice has been raised, I promise you.
Well, it's fantastic. And the play, I really don't know about the play. I read that it's 27th
Man, yeah.
27th Man. Tell us about that.
Sure. This was, I called the Rip Van Winkle contract, but when my first book came out, I heard from my agent. She said, and I miss her deeply, but that Nora Ephron, when Harry Met Sally, the director and everything, the director and producer and essayist and novelist, the very brilliant Nora Ephron, wanted to take me for a lunch, which is a lunch I wanted to take. I was, 12 years old in short pants. But she had read the book just out of nowhere and just had read the book and read this story and saw a play in it and wanted to produce this play only if I would write this play. And I asked for permission to write my novel first. She said, great, that took 10 years. I came back and she was waiting, and she really, to me, it was just this life-changing thing, back to this translation of all I ever dreamed of was being a writer, but of literary fiction, this very frame thing. And working in these other forms made me see that one can be passionate about other things and what it is, at this age to relearn, just like dialogue. There's a way people talk, and then there's the two of us talking, and I hope this sounds natural, but it's the natural way that we talk, knowing that there's microphones and this wonderful audience. Like, and then when you write a story, it's like dialogue is the way people read, and they're going to hear it in their brain. Well, I had to literally, after all these years of writing, relearn how to write, and I would draft and draft and draft and go to her house, and she'd, give me bagels and beat me up and send me home, and we would do this for a year, and then eventually she sent it to the wonderful people at the Public Theater in New York, Hair, Chorus Line, Shakespeare in the Park. So it's, Oscar Eustace, the wonderful director, and now runs the Old Globe in San Diego, Barry Edelstein, my director, Oscar Eustace's dramaturge and who runs the theater. But they just gave me this opportunity, and then after Nora was done brutalizing me, they brutalized me endlessly. And 3 years later, we had a play open this fall with a wonderful cast, with Ron Rifkin and
Ron Rifkin
and Byron Jennings and Chip Zian and
Dan just a plot summary of The 27th Man is
yet another cheery story for me. When I was dreaming of writing, I guess I had heard, this is back to Israel, I did my junior year there, I was 19, and I heard, this is right before the wall came down in Berlin, which is 20 years ago, I guess, a little more, 23. Anyway, but right before the wall came down, I just heard this story this teacher mentioned as a side in a separate class, that Stalin in 1952 he'd rounded up and killed, and he was just killing everybody. You'd go over to his house to play pinochle, and then he'd kill your wife, and then he'd kill you, then he'd kill your dog. He was just mad with murder, but he rounded up basically the last of the Yiddish writers and had them all murdered, and we knew nothing. And I was dreaming of being a writer as 19, and I thought, here these writers have been murdered, and nobody, it was just sort of a rumor that had, like, people knew that at this time, just the idea of it was getting out to the West, and I thought they've been denied the greatest story of their life. Someone owes them. I thought a real writer should write these people a story, and I waited for years, and nobody was writing them a story. So that was what I consider my first, grown-up adult. I just decided I would try and do it. And the idea is that in this cell with these great men, a young writer who's never been published, never been heard of, from a little inn on a mountaintop, has been thrown in somehow with all these legends to be executed. And the real question, which is the question I was asking myself, which is, because you don't know you're going to get to be a writer if you dream of writing, which is, if no one ever reads a word, are you a writer if you write and nobody ever hears or sees or reads a word? And it's an exploration of that. Simply, is this little boy dying with these legends, like, is it as a writer that he dies?
Ah, fantastic. Nathan Owen, thank you so much for stopping by. I know you're busy and you're getting ready to leave our shores once again.
I'll be back.
Love the writing. It's a great pleasure meeting
you. Thank you so much. What a treat.
Nathan Englander, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much.